Buddy, elections are coming up for the KBOO Board of Directors. Right now, we're looking for board candidates with skills in finance, new media, and nonprofit development. So if this sounds like you or someone you know, you can download a copy of the board candidate package at kboo.fm or pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The application deadline is midnight, June 30th, so don't delay. And thank you for supporting Community Radio, KBOO.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagring, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest is Raed Jarar, who is a Iraqi American writer and political analyst. And he's been a guest before, years, some time ago, but recently on Democracy Now. Raed Jarar, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Well, looks like the latest we hear from Iraq is that the Sunni rebels have taken over this oil refinery, and Al-Maliki wants the U.S. to bomb them, and the U.S. says he won't unless he changes his sectarian ways. Is that the latest, or is that it?
Well, I mean, news are coming in by the minute, but the latest is that there are some advances by armed groups who are predominantly Sunni, and Al-Maliki and his government are asking for foreign support from Iran and the United States. Iran sent a couple thousand soldiers to Iraq in the last week from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and pictures of the first member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard who was killed in Iraq surfaced a few days ago on the Iranian media. The U.S. has been more hesitant in sending support to Al-Maliki, and it seems that the Obama administration has been they've been very clear with the Iraqi government that they are not going to send any troops. That was the first thing that was ruled out. Then they ruled out any airstrikes. And today's news on the Independent, the British media, indicates that the Obama administration is asking Al-Maliki to step down as a condition for any U.S. military involvement.
But it really said to step down?
This is the latest report that, according to the Independent, that the U.S. Indicated to the Iraqi government that there will not be any U.S. support as long as Al-Maliki is the prime minister, because the U.S. sees him as a part of the problem. He failed to build a unity government. So that said, it seems that the U.S. Continues to research and think about ideas of collaborating with the Iraqi government. It doesn't seem like there is any interest from the U.S. side to reach out to the armed groups behind the rebellion. There are four or five main groups behind the rebellion in the six Sunni provinces in Iraq. Unfortunately, so far, the U.S. rhetoric has been very anti any attempts to reach out to these groups. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to portray a picture of all the groups being affiliated with terrorist organizations. There is so much emphasis on one of the groups, the most controversial one, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, and attempts to portray the conflict as if it's a conflict between this one group and the Iraqi central government.
Well, who would replace al-Malik if he stepped down? Would the vice president become the ruler? Or?
You mean the deputy prime minister, because the Maliki is not the president. He's the prime minister. I mean, technically, yes, but in Iraq, no, because of the sectarian quotas that were created. There is this, you know, what Iraqis call the sectarian allocationism. You know, like the, like you get your picked your position based on your sectarian background. So the al-Maliki has two deputies. One of them is Sunni and the other is Kurdish. And the idea of having a Sunni or Kurdish prime minister in this Iraqi political system is almost impossible because according to this sectarian-based system that was created by the U.S. and U.S. allies in 2003, Iraq's prime minister must be a Shiite, which is something that Iraqis never experienced before 2003. Iraqis were never chosen to run the country or be at specific positions based on their sectarian affiliations before. So although in other countries a deputy prime minister will step in to fill the gap, in Iraq, this will not happen for two reasons. The first one is what I just explained about how the system is based on sectarian allocations, and a Sunni or a Kurd will not fill a Shiite position. And more importantly, this is a lame duck government in Iraq now, because the Iraqi elections just took place a few weeks ago. And no one managed to get a majority in the parliament. So, this of course makes it more complicated to pick the next prime minister, because there is no consensus, even among the Shiite parties, there is no consensus to nominate al-Maliki. So even if the U.S. Did not say this, even if the U.S. did not bring up the issue of al-Maliki stepping down, this is a real problem in Iraq, because al-Maliki's own allies, his own party partners in the parliament, do not want him to run again as a prime minister. And these include Muqtada al-Sadr and so the Sadrist movement, and the Supreme Council of Iraq run by Hakim, and another newer group that is controlled by former Prime Minister Jaafari. So these are the three main Shiite allies of al-Maliki. And these three people don't want him to run again either. So he's really stuck, you know, like he doesn't have that much support from the U.S., doesn't have that much support from his own Shiite allies, and he definitely has no support from any legitimate Sunni parties, and his relationships with the Kurdish parties are deteriorating as well. So that is an interesting development politically, parallel to what's happening on the ground in Iraq.
I heard that Ahmad Chalabi is sort of back in in contention also.
Well, Ahmad Chalabi is always somewhere in the background. Uh-huh. So he never goes away. But Yeah, no, I don't think he's a serious contender for any public position.
Well, now these three contenders, how do they stand in regard to Iran? Supposedly al-Maliki was a sort of allied with Iran.
He was. Al-Maliki was a good choice for Iran because he wasn't very close to Iran. So he managed to get some partners from other groups, but he was friendly enough for the Iranian government. And the Iranian government always had so much leverage over him because during the last election period, 4 years ago, Maliki's coalition lost the election, and former Prime Minister Alawi's coalition, Al-Iraqiya, won. So according to the Iraqi constitution, Al-Iraqiya, led by Iyad Alawi, should have been given the first attempt to form a government. But what happened is that Iran played a major role in pulling all of the Shiite parties to Iran. They had a convening there, and they pressured all of them to endorse al-Maliki and circumvent the Iraqi laws. So in a way, Iran played a kingmaker role during the last election period. And so when this happened, al-Maliki went running to Iran to save him, and that's why they sent the few thousand troops to try to keep him in control. But at one moment, I think he will end up turning into more of a liability on Iran than an asset. So I'm not sure of that point, if we have reached that point yet. But definitely there is no other contender, and this is the dreadlock that Iraq is dealing with. So after 13 years of... 11 years of this new political system that was installed by the U.S., the system has virtually collapsed. I mean, just to give you an example of how dysfunctional this system is, on the one hand, it's among the most corrupt political systems in the world. Iraq is the fourth most corrupt. Said most corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International. It's one of the most dysfunctional countries in the world. A good example of what happened last week, Mr. al-Maliki ordered the parliament to convene and pass martial laws because of what happened in the north. So... The parliament tried to convene, It was, in a way, the parliament convening to end their role in the political process. That's what martial law is. And the system is so dysfunctional that the parliament could not convene because they could not get a quorum. So most of the members of parliament have fled the country already. And they're not present there to just, be in the room so that there will be a quorum to pass martial law. I mean, I think that this is really hitting rock bottom for the Iraqi political process.
Well, is anyone in charge of fighting the insurgents?
It depends on who you ask. Because, let me unpack a little bit some details about who's fighting in these six Iraqi provinces. Now, there isn't a universal word to describe them. Some people call them terrorists. Some people call them insurgents. Some people call them, freedom fighters. And the Iraqi vice president, who just quit and ran away to Turkey a couple of years ago, Mr. Tariq al-Hashimi, calls what's going on in Iraq now the Iraqi Spring. So it's a very controversial issue, as you would imagine, and there are so many different narratives. There are at least five main players in what's going on in these six provinces that have been revolting for the last couple of weeks. The one that we've heard about the most is the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I personally don't think they are as large as they're being portrayed in the U.S. media. They're a little bit smaller and less organized, and they are not affiliated with Al-Qaeda at all. Actually, they are in an open war with Al-Qaeda. They have been in an open war with Al-Qaeda for the last 3 or 4 months inside Syria. And Al-Qaeda's the number one man in Al-Qaeda Central, Ayman al-Zawahiri, gave the public statements condemning ISIL or ISIS for their role in Syria and for the attacking Al-Qaeda fighters there. It's a bloody war between them and Al-Qaeda, so calling them an offshoot of Al-Qaeda is actually ridiculous. They're an Al-Qaeda rival. Other members that are important to mention are former members of the Iraqi government, so the Saddam Hussein government, remnants from that government, led by Saddam Hussein's vice president, Mr. Izzat al-Duri. Al-Duri has been living somewhere in Iraq since 2003, and no one managed to capture him. And he leads what he calls now Al-Naqshbandiya group, which, you know, has all of these former Iraqi army officials and army officers. They're very well trained, and they're very high caliber bureaucrats who can lead larger movements. Just to give you an example, when one of the air bases fell in Mosul last week, a couple of jet fighters were used from the airbase to bomb another site that the Iraqi government was still controlling. So just the fact that whomever is behind this uprising can manage to get two pilots to fly two jet fighters in a few hours is a good indication that they are very well trained. This is they come from real government institutions, not just a bunch of crazy extremists who are running around with the AK-47. Other groups I want to mention include the most important group in everything that has been going on, which are the tribal leaders. So many of Iraq's major tribes, such as Al-Dulaym and Al-Jubur, have joined this uprising. This is unprecedented. It hasn't happened in Iraq since the 1920s. And they have tens of thousands of very well-armed men. And the fact that they participated, I think, was the straw that broke the Iraqi government's back. Because without tribal participation, any group can't really have that much public support. Smaller groups include the 1920 Brigades and the Islamic Army in Iraq and Al-Mujahideen Army and Muhammad's Army. These are all smaller militia groups that fought against the U.S. presence there. So what I'm trying to say is there are so many different players on the uprising side, people who can actually run a country who are participating. And that's why, you know, like, for example, they took over, as you mentioned, the refinery in Beji yesterday, and they have enough technical expertise to run a refinery. Now, a terrorist group will not have a bunch of trained engineers and technicians with them running around, you know. So definitely there is some legitimacy to the uprising. There are definitely legitimate grievances for people who live in these six provinces. And there are definitely a number of extremist groups who are bad news for Iraq and the region. So it's a more mixed picture than what we're seeing on U.S. TV stations.
But now the Shia are still a majority. I mean, does it seem possible that that these insurgents can take over the whole country, or are they going to be kind of confined to their own area?
So Iraq used to be more demographically mixed before 2003. Mm-hmm. And so, like, for example, most of my family are, like myself, are half Sunnis and half Shiites. You know, my mother is a Shiite, my father is a Sunni. People intermarried and lived in the same areas. And during that time, issues of control of one sect over the other were not really a part of public consciousness. Now, there was one of the largest ethnic cleansing and sectarian cleansing campaigns in the history of the region, actually, like maybe since the creation of Israel in 1948, that happened now in Iraq in the last decade. So now we do have provinces that are almost exclusively Sunni or almost exclusively Shiite or almost exclusively Kurdish. And this created a new reality on the ground. So when there is a Sunni uprising, they will definitely be more able to control the Sunni areas in Iraq than the central government that is now almost exclusively Shiite. It doesn't have any Sunni participation in it anymore. So it's now that, but your question is the most important question in what's going on in these weeks. Is this uprising going to end with a Sunni partition in Iraq? Is it going to create a Sunnistan that looks like Kurdistan? Or is it an uprising that will get to Baghdad and topple the government and try to create a new rule for the entire country that includes the Shia provinces as well? I think this is a very heated debate, even among the main forces who are leading the rebellion. Some people want to stop now and just maintain whatever they have, and some people don't want to partition Iraq. They want to go all the way to Baghdad and bring the entire political system down and replace it by a new one. So it's a mixed bag, I would say. To be realistic, it's really hard to convince all of the Shiite population in Iraq after all of these years that you know, what's going on now is not a sectarian uprising. It is definitely a one-sect uprising, whether they liked it or not. So it's very hard to convince the millions of Shiites and Basra and Kut and the south in Iraq that these millions of Sunnis will come to Baghdad to replace the regime that has been exclusively Shiite and has been killing them for the last decade, and they will replace it with a regime that is all inclusive and you will have a place on the table. I don't think people will buy that. I think the anticipation is that it's time for payback, and people in the south are really worried that what will happen now is a government that is as sectarian as the one that Iraq had in the last decade, but it will be a Sunni sectarian government rather than a Shiite one. Well, but there are so many fears and worries, and I don't really see a happy ending for this for this uprising. I don't think Iraqis will just hold hands next week and create a national unity government. So unfortunately, it seems that the forecast is that there will be more violence and more bloodshed. It doesn't seem like it will be like a stable and easy transition. So the next few weeks and months will definitely be really violent.
Well, I guess Saddam Hussein was able to rule over Iraq with his Sunni-dominated government for years, and he was able to put down opposition.
You know, this is actually a misperception that was created by the U.S. in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
The former Iraqi government was very secular. You know, it was led by the Ba'ath Party, which is a secular, almost anti-religious party, like a pan-Arabist party.
Mm-hmm.
It had very anti-Kurdish sentiments, and there was definitely an anti-Kurdish rhetoric for the government and the party. But there was no recognition of the sectarian divisions that much. I mean, one example that I always give to U.S. audiences, sometimes people doubt my own experience. You know, I lived in Baghdad, I come in from a mixed family. But one the example that I give is the deck of cards, the 55 Iraqi leaders who were printed on a deck of cards after the fall of Baghdad, and the U.S. government announced that these were indeed the top leaders that run the country. They are the core of the dictatorship. I'm sure you remember those, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah, out of the 55, 36 are Shiites. I mean, just the fact that this is what the CIA and the administration, the Bush administration, told us, that these are the rulers of the country. And the fact that, you know, almost 60% of them were Shiites is actually a very fair indicator that the former Iraqi dictatorship was not a sectarian one. It was a bloody dictatorship, a political dictatorship, mm-hmm. and definitely had, you know, negative implications against Kurds. But I don't think that there is evidence that the former Iraqi government was a Sunni regime running Shiites. I mean, that is not true. And there were Shiite Iraqis in very predominant positions. Even the head of the chief of staff in Iraq was a Shiite in the military. So, yeah, I mean, I always say like that this is not to be mistaken by saying the former Iraqi government was nice and inclusive, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was a bloody dictatorship, but it wasn't a sectarian one.
Well, is this what the U.S. is pushing for? I mean, we know the U.S. Was pushing for this cleansing that you talked about. And now they, I don't know, the neocons who sort of responsible for much of this. You're in Washington. What's it like now? The neocons still have a lot of respect in Washington. Can't believe it. They've been wrong about so many things.
I don't think they have much respect in D.C. because I think the last couple of weeks when we heard the same voices come out to justify another invasion or intervention in Iraq, people were not impressed, you know. I think people left them out of the door, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Cheney writes an op-ed for the for the Wall Street Journal, promoting more intervention in Iraq. I mean, seriously, who takes that seriously? You know, like people actually laughed at these jokers who took the U.S. to war the first place.
Well, I heard Wolfowitz on the radio and Richard Pearl.
Yeah, so. Mm-hmm.
But actually,
I'm not sure who invites them or takes them personally. But the point that I want to make, you make a good question, which is, what does the U.S. want? This is a good question because I don't think the U.S. at this stage knows what it wants. The Obama administration has an extremely confused policy in the Middle East in general, and in Iraq in particular. I mean, just to give you an example of how much contradiction there is in the Obama administration's policy in Iraq, the Obama administration has been, at least with their rhetoric, supporting some factions in the armed opposition in Syria
in the last
few years, and opposing Bashar al-Assad regime. Many people say they're just doing that as lip service, they're not doing anything. But at least this is their announced position.
Well,
they're supporting some factions of the armed opposition and opposing the regime. In Iraq, their public position is that they're supporting the regime and opposing the armed groups who are behind the uprising. Now, the funny thing is that the Syrian regime and the Iraqi regime are allies, and the armed groups in Iraq and Syria who are behind the uprising are either exactly the same or linked. You know, like the same tribes, ISIS is on both sides. Some of the groups have extensions. So the Obama administration is sending weapons to fund the uprising in Syria and bring down the regime. And across the border, they're sending weapons to fund the Iraqi government and bring down the uprising.
Oh, boy.
It's exactly the opposite policy.
I guess we're going to have to end on that note. The confusion continues. We've been speaking with Riad Jarrar, a Iraqi-American political analyst and writer. Thank you very much for being with us to help sort this all out.
Well, thank you. I hope I didn't confuse you even more.
Well, I don't think so. I think we're getting a handle on it, but I think we will continue trying. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. It is 10 o'clock and just about time for Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Stick around. She's coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual What the Festival, June 20th through 23rd in Duver, Oregon. What the Festival is an annual electronics festival which this year features the Glitch Mob, Washed Out, Nightmares on Wax, and more. There will also be a hookah lounge, relaxation huts, and the largest disco ball on the West Coast. Again, that's What the Festival? June 20th through 23rd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Duver, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.